versus Anderson. Mr. Friedman?
May it please the Court, my name is Alan Friedman, representing the appellant petitioner in this case. This is the second time this court has reviewed the state death sentence. The first time this court reversed the district court and ordered an evidentiary hearing because it found a legitimate question, a bona fide doubt of the petitioner's competency at trial. There was an evidentiary hearing heard at the district court, and ultimately the district court denied the petition again. We submit that there should be a reversal here. There's a lot of interesting questions about burden of proof and what standard to be used, but putting all that aside, we submit that the evidence, regardless of the standard, is overwhelming, and that there's absolutely no overwhelming evidence that the petitioner was incompetent at the time of trial, and there's no evidence contradicting that whatsoever. And that occurred in this case because the appellee respondent's attorney was incompetent or didn't know what he was doing. He searched the file completely, and it took a while. He had the prison records, what have you. There was no evidence to create to show that he was competent to trial, because this was a retrospective hearing, and it was impossible to do that, because it was only one expert in this case that actually, at the time of the trial, examined the petitioner for competency. And I mean, that's just a critical point. The two state experts, for whatever reason, and this court went through that in a lengthy opinion the first time around, did not examine him for competency. One of them, Dr. Bertson, passed away, and Dr. Batikin,
testified too, though, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
So there was more than just the medical evidence. There was also the testimony of the officer.
Yes, there was, and part of the test, and that's part of the factor, and I can get into that right away. But the lawyer's testimony really doesn't indicate that he's competent. In fact, they say he is competent. However, they describe somebody who is incompetent and is consistent with the sole medical testimony of Dr. Morrison.
Well, he describes somebody who had a misapprehension of what a defense to a murder case is.
I don't think that's what the record shows. I mean, what it shows is, first of all, the lead lawyer, Mr.
Scott King,
testified in a deposition in post conviction that he attempted to reason with the appellant and had no lasting impact, and that he was absolutely no assistance.
What he was trying to tell him, reasoning, is to tell him that what the defendant wanted him to present was not a defense.
But he also says the reason. Scott King's testimony also says he believed the reason for this was his mental illness. He said it was not just because he was a difficult client.
He didn't want to believe the lawyer when he told him that's not a defense.
But it was all based on the conspiracy.
Have you ever had a client, Mr. Freeman, who didn't want you to present a defense that really wasn't a defense?
Of course. I mean, that's common in criminal cases. But also, there are also cases...
You're talking about crazy or anything, or incompetent. It just means you don't understand or don't want to accept the fact that the law isn't against them.
But on the facts of this record, the client is incompetent.
I'm not quarreling with what your argument on the subject. I just want to know whether it would hold light altogether.
I would suppose that somebody at trial for his life could be a difficult client, but it's the role of experts to sort out malingerers and somebody who has a fixed delusion. And
did Dr. Morrison actually use the legal standard in making her determination about competency to stand trial?
Yes, she did.
And she phrased it as you would have to phrase it in court.
Yes, I believe so, and I think what you're alluding to is one of the reasonings from the district court. It's like, well, she used the word assist rather than consult. One, I believe there's a difference of no difference, and if you actually look at the leading case that comes out with the standard drove, I mean, and may I indulge the court? May I read? You don't want us to read from an opinion, but one sentence from that opinion says, Chief Judge Berger said, It is long, determining the standard probably for the first time, it has been long accepted that a person whose mental condition is such that lacks the capacity to understand the nature and the object of proceedings against him, to consult with counsel and to assist in the preparing defense may not be subject to a trial.
Well, if you don't have any defense, how could you have done assisting in the defense? If the defense is not what the defendant wants you to put out.
I like to respond in twofold. One, that's really not, the standard. If somebody's incompetent to stand trial, it's not a factor how helpful that assistance is.
If there's no possibility of assistance, that is, there's nothing to assist.
But I believe there would have been probably stuff to assist as to,
like what?
As to mitigation. He was reluctant as to dealing with mitigation. I mean, obviously, the issue of guilt and innocence was no question about that. I mean, and getting back even to what Scott King said, he said, the only assistance that I got out of the client from his mental illness was I could raise a possible insanity defense. And so,
Well, there was a testimony of Charles Leahy and the other counsel that they said he was competent, at least as reported in the state court opinion.
Right. Yeah. I mean, but you have to look, first of all, Leahy and Kaczynski, the other two lawyers that were involved in this case, never spoke to any mental health experts. I mean, so King really was the one that was doing that. Then their analysis of it is way off. They reached the conclusion of competency based on whether he was oriented in time and place. That's not the standard at all. I mean, and in fact, the earlier case, Dusky, from the Supreme Court, that petitioner was found incompetent. He was also oriented in time and place. What Leahy said, even after they were talking about that he was competent to stand trial, they described him as confused, kept on popping off in court, and then getting back to he was obsessed with this conspiracy theory and couldn't be reasoned. Everything got hooked up into conspiracy theory. And that occurred throughout the whole. I mean, another point that really is important when you look at the lawyers is that before the client committed this unfortunate homicide, he was still involved in this conspiracy. This was a deterioration of the petitioner. His original attorneys that was involved in the kidnapping, Scopelius, talked about this conspiracy that he had, and that if you discounted the conspiracy, you became part of the conspiracy. So that the process that constantly deterred. So it's not just a client that's difficult. He became obsessed with this conspiracy, and everything was connected to it.
Isn't the biggest issue for us the fact that Judge Sharp relied on a test for competency that is without a support in the law?
Right.
In other words, he believes that the test didn't require that a defendant be able to rationally assist in his defense, just that he possesses this present ability to consult. And can you, and I'll ask Mr. Perkins the same question I expect, but can you conceive of a situation in which a defendant can consult with rational understanding but can't assist in his defense?
I think those words are interchangeable, and I think when you read Rope, I mean, this is a distinction of no distinction. And he couldn't cooperate with his attorney. Some of the opinions, if you look at all the opinions that have been offered by this court, the Supreme Court, they talk in terms of whether they can cooperate and work with the attorney. And the words consult and assist are interchangeable. Just like what Chief Judge Berger did in Drope. They're interchangeable. I mean, I think, and all due respect to Judge Sharp, and I've heard many cases in front of him, I think he was looking for a distinction to try to justify his previous opinion. And it's a distinction of no distinction whatsoever. And the The second problem, which I think I just covered without repeating myself, he relied, the other basis, to discount Dr. Morris's uncontested testimony here, which is both by deposition and there's a videotape. The court can actually get an opportunity to review her testimony. The lawyer is simply puzzling, asked to move to have him examined for competency. Never did that. And then said he wasn't incompetent, and then described somebody that at least had a legitimate doubt of his competency. At the minimum, the facial reading. And then when you read that in conjunction with Dr. Morris's testimony, you have to conclude that this individual at least was incompetent at the time of trial, based on this fixed belief, this fixed delusion.
And of course, there's no state determination of trial competency.
No, none whatsoever. No, I mean that, and so going through the facts, I mean, which I think I've covered, and they're in the brief. But I would just like to say, as to the procedural point, even not only the procedural error of the district court using the wrong standard, there's also a significant question of the who has the burden, at least the burden of persuasion. When this court sent it back, they found a legitimate doubt of competency. There's no question about that. And we also submitted the testimony of Helen Morrison. I think that even if this was a close case, and I don't think that it is a close case, we should prevail here because they can't rebut it. And this court, and I believe the opinion was authored by one of the panel members, Judge Bowling and Galinsky versus Burge, indicated that the state on a retrospective hearing should have the burden of persuasion once the petitioner made a prima facie case. And that prima facie case was already offered in the original case at the time. And again, could not rebut that. It would be horribly unfair to place the burden on the petitioner in a retrospective hearing, because most of the cases, Pate, Drope, and Dusky don't even give a retrospective hearing. They give release immediately. So to have any fairness on a retrospective hearing, the burden must shift. One other point before I sit down, I mean, and I want to close, not only is this something that the description of the petitioner here has come out through Dr. Morrison and has come out through the description of his trial lawyers, this has occurred throughout its whole period of time, 5 or 6 years before. So that would, and it's totally consistent with it. There's no evidence of malingering at all. If you're searching for that type of question, in fact, even the prison doctors found that this obsession with this fixed delusion that the prosecutor was conspiring with the victim. If there's any other questions, I would just conclude that the petition, that there should be a reversal here, finding that he was incompetent to stand trial and order a new trial.
In essence, it's a logic-tight compartment, is it not?
What's that?
It's a logic-tight compartment.
Yeah.
There's no way.
No, not on this fact. I mean, this is the strongest I've seen, and I'm stronger, I mean, than even the recent case of Brown versus Stern that the Coffey offered for the court. I mean, this has been consistent throughout, and then when you deal with the length of time, the only degree of fairness, even an attempt at retrospective hearing, and there was no evidence that could be surfaced. And this is not like the state dropped the ball. There's no evidence that could be obtained.
Thank you, Mr. Friedman. Mr. Perkins?
Please, the court. My name is Tom Perkins on behalf of the respondent, Appellee. First of all, regardless of what the burden of proof was, the district court properly complied with the remand order of this court and found the petitioner was competent at the time of trial. To answer Judge Roedner's question about whether there's a difference between able to consult and able to assist. I think there is a difference, but ultimately in the district court's determination, it didn't really matter. I can envision a situation where...
I don't see how you can say it didn't matter when Judge Sharp, you know, relied on the... he actually declared the test does not require that a defendant be able to rationally assist in his defense, just that he possess a present ability to consult with counsel with a reasonable degree of rational understanding. Judge Sharp was overruling Drope versus Missouri in that statement.
I understand that with that analysis he was drawing a distinction between assist and consult, but in looking at the final paragraph of this part of the analysis on page 38 of his order, he said, additionally, he, referring to petitioner, provided assistance to his counsel, who notably did not consider Matheny to be incompetent. So ultimately, the district court found that he did assist his attorneys, and that is confirmed by Dr. Morrison's testimony.
Sounds like a little bit addicted to me. He's already ruled, mistakenly, what the test is. But we could argue that, you know, forever.
Sure. And I would place my reliance on Drope and Dusky and say that regardless whether one considers the difference between consult and assist, in this case, petitioner was able to rationally assist and, in fact, did assist in his defense.
How can you say that he could rationally do anything? A man who, as I noted earlier, has a logic-type compartment where everything is a conspiracy. Everything leads back to this original conspiracy. How can such a person assist in anything? He's mad as a hatter.
Preliminarily, one can be insane and can in fact have a mental disease or defect and still be competent. That is almost irrefutable, I mean, in the law. The point here is that, and I defer to Dr. Morrison, that he was able to take direction from counsel.
It's a remarkable system that puts to death the insane, isn't it?
Your Honor, we do have a system of rules in place to define who is eligible for the death penalty. Petitioner meets the criteria. One can suffer a mental disease or defect and be executed for outrageous murders. I'm sure I can find many cases to support that proposition. But in this case, I defer to Dr. Morrison, who said that petitioner was able to take direction from counsel to participate in the mental health examinations. In fact, there was one situation where a doctor wanted to evaluate petitioner, and he declined until his attorneys told him that it was okay to do so. He did not want to participate in any evaluation without the consent of his attorney.
Two of his lawyers did say that they thought he was able to assist them.
Indeed, Your Honor, that is true. And that
Skidinski,
is... Skidinski and Leahy.
When asked if he was competent to assist, replied, I think he was. He certainly understood what he was charged with and what evidence to find him not guilty. In that regard, I guess he was competent to assist his own defense. And the other counsel responded as well that he thought he could. He wasn't of much help, but it wasn't because he was incompetent.
That's right, Your Honor.
Of course, Leahy also said that the petitioner, quote, was obsessed with this defense, meaning this deranged defense, and exhibited refusal or inability to work with defense counsel, with us, on any evidence other than along those lines, this deranged conspiracy theory. That he was unable to convince Matheny that it was not a defense and to reason with him, and that his behavior made it a chore to talk to him and made him of no real effective assistance to us whatsoever on what real legitimate issues existed in the case.
And Dr. Morrison's testimony in her deposition for the evidentiary hearing on remand stated that petitioner was able to consult with his attorneys regarding the factual considerations of the case, and that his memory was intact. He was able to discuss with his attorneys what he did on the day of the murder, how he did it, and all of those questions, or the answer to those questions, go to his ability to assist his attorneys to prepare a defense. They were able to examine any factual chinks in the state's armor. They were able to direct him to cooperate with mental health evaluations with an eye towards presenting the insanity defense. He did, in fact, assist his attorneys. He may have been a chore to work with, but that does not make a criminal defendant incompetent.
Now, the state court never addressed whether he was competent to stand trial, did it?
That's correct, Your Honor. The state court did address his competence at the post-conviction proceedings. It was alleged that the state post-conviction proceedings should be stayed because he was incompetent. At that point, applying the trial standard for competence, the post-conviction court found him to be competent to pursue the post-conviction proceedings.
Aren't you really asking us to take a distinct state court ruling? In other words, his competence to pursue post-conviction relief, and you're asking us to apply the AEDPA standard to that ruling on the separate issue before this court of his competence to stand trial, and those are not identical issues. So how is it appropriate to do that?
There's been absolutely no proof that petitioner's delusions or his mental illness has fluctuated in such a way that it would have been worse at trial than it was at post-conviction proceedings. It has been either stable or has progressively gotten worse to this day. So even under that latter scenario, he was less mentally ill at trial than he would have been at post-conviction proceedings. In that light, if he was competent at the post-conviction proceedings, it is an extension. I'm not trying to say that this is directly supported by anything, but even Young versus Wallace says that in a retrospective situation where we're trying to establish competence at a prior time, if he was competent at the post-conviction proceedings, it is a very small step to say that he was also competent at trial.
It's a very dangerous step, is it not?
No, Your Honor, it is not.
It takes two issues that are very different.
Ultimately, it's our position that it's the same issue. It is the issue whether he understands the proceedings and whether he is rationally able to assist and consult with his attorney.
Well, then, I suppose we should never ask state courts to address these issues, and we'll just take whatever comes next.
In this case, what should come next would be an affirmance of the district court's denial of relief on this in this issue. The district court properly found the petitioner was competent at trial. While Dr. Morrison is the only witness to testify at trial, there's absolutely nothing wrong with looking at the existing record and comparing it to what Dr. Morrison testified to and reaching the conclusion that petitioner was competent at the time of trial. And again, this goes to, regardless what who bears the burden of proof, the burden of persuasion, there's ample evidence, even from Dr. Morrison's testimony, that petitioner was competent to stand trial. There are no other questions. I see my remaining time.
Thank you, Mr. Perkins. Mr. Friedman?
I'm no expert, and I can't testify whether my client's competent now or not competent, but you can't go from what happens in post-conviction or what happens at the trial. You don't know what medication, sometimes he takes medication, sometimes he doesn't. But what is consistent throughout this record is this obsession, disillusion that the prosecutor and his wife were conspiring, and the conspiracy got broadened once you challenged that. And it's not just the case with somebody where this is a death penalty case, somebody is doing this to save his life. He would do this over a parking ticket. This is part of the consistency throughout the system. And it was heightened at the trial. Even if you look at the documents that the state is referring to, that he said, well, the lawyer said don't cooperate. Well, he didn't like to cooperate, but furthermore, after he had the conversation with this doctor about this conspiracy came out. and every the conversation based on that, and the doctor said he's probably extremely paranoid, and the condition was there. And the lawyers noted that throughout the whole proceedings. If there's anything else, right, we would stand that this is an extreme case of it.
Scott King's only evidence in this in the post-conviction matters is by deposition.
What's that?
Scott King's.
Yes, the lawyers testified only by deposition. The only, I believe it was by deposition. I don't think they even testified live in post-conviction. I think all the lawyers testified. The only live testimony was Helen Morrison and a few other reports that indicated that. Nobody, I mean, and that also related to the ineffective assistance of on the issue of competency. It was puzzling that they knew that he had this mental condition, never even spoke to their own expert who examined him on competency and tried to explain to them that he technically didn't meet the Indiana standard for insanity. But there was other problems here, and that they just went past that. It's just a simple case of lawyers not understanding the standard for competency and confusing it with insanity. And this is an extreme case, and the period of time really shows that there's no evidence of malingering at all. This is not he's consistent throughout the periods of a decade on this as he deteriorated, and none of that evidence has been contested. If there's anything else, I'd ask for a reversal.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning.